A little corner grocery store doesn't have to worry about setting ethical prices. The corner grocery store is under such competitive pressure that the guy sets the best price he can, and it's always being pushed down too low for him, and he's trying to push it back up. He doesn't have to worry about being ethical. When businessmen start talking about the necessity for being ethical and responsible, aren't they admitting that they have an awful lot of power? And if they have that much power, shouldn't we take it away from them? But now, if they have it, how much power do businessmen have? By the way, this is the point that Reinhold Niebuhr is making in his famous Moral Man and Immoral Society. And stuck this in a couple weeks ago because J.B. Halverson was talking about it. He's a great fan of Niebuhr. In 1932, when Niebuhr wrote this very important book, Moral Man and Immoral Society, he was attacking what he called the liberal illusion that you could rely upon religion and education and morality to do tasks that could only be performed by law and coercion. And competition is a form of coercion. You simply can't educate and indoctrinate and moralize the people and expect the society to work well because of that. You have to have constraints. You have to limit people in what they can do, otherwise you are going to get injustice. Well, one very simple explanation for this is that nobody is a good judge in his own case. You ask me to make an ethical apportionment of something. You know, well, they ask two little kids, you know, here's a piece of cake, split it ethically. In any really important decision, we can find good and sufficient reasons for proving that in justice we ought to get the lion's share. No businessman has ever been at a loss to come up with explanations for anything he cared to do.
Don't feel alone, don't worry.
Let me just rehash this in this way. Economizing is what the economic system does. And economizing means putting our resources to work. That's our labor and our land and our capital and all of our resources, human and non-human resources, putting them to work in such a way as to secure a maximum of whatever it is we want with a minimum of effort. This is what economizing means. This is what you do when you economize in your family budget. You take a look at your resources and you say, how can we get out of these resources the most of whatever it is we want? Well, now, economizing is society's task. It is society that ought to be served by the economizing process. And therefore, we cannot rely upon businessmen to make these decisions by themselves. Society has to compel businessmen to economize in the way in which society wants economizing to be done. We cannot ask businessmen to produce those things which they think are good for us. We must ask them to produce those things which we want, even though we often want rather silly things. I would rather that we wanted silly things than the businessmen were so insolent and arrogant as to suppose that they knew what was really good for us. This begins to smell of the brave new world. In any event, if there is simply no way, no effective way, no acceptable way in which businessmen can perform this task in the absence of competition. Competition assures, more or less, and the more competitive, the more it assures it, that society's goals are being achieved in the economizing process. Society, through the forces of competition, guarantees that too many resources will not be devoted to the production of hula hoops, or that businessmen will not go out and build refrigerators when in fact we want hair tonic. It's competition that gets resources used in the way that we want them used. But now, if there is not adequate competition, and we turn to the businessman and we say, all right, you guys now use your conscience, because, you know, there's monopoly here, and so competition is not exerting sufficient pressure, so use your conscience. There are several reasons why this just isn't going to work, and if it did work, it wouldn't be acceptable. In the first place, there's a simple lack of knowledge. We are extraordinarily naive about the difficulty of the task of deciding what to produce and how to produce it. We say, this is a statement you often run across, in a capitalist system, all sorts of things are produced that aren't really needed. If we were to reorganize this under socialism, then the economy would produce what people need. What do people need? What does need mean? What do you need? What's the difference between need and want? And how do you determine what people need or want anyway? Do you want a Cadillac? I assume you don't have one, so you want a Cadillac? At a sufficiently low price, you'd want one, wouldn't you? It depends upon the price. And what determines the price? The cost of producing it. And what determines the cost of producing it? Largely, what other things we are producing. If all of a sudden Americans decided they didn't want durable goods, the supply of durable goods available for the production of Cadillacs would increase so much that the price of Cadillacs would come way down. And then lots of people would suddenly find themselves wanting Cadillacs. Everything depends upon everything else. And there simply is no device by which any conscienceful men can sit up there somewhere and decide what ought to be produced and how it ought to be produced. There's no way to do it. They haven't got the knowledge. Moreover, when they're called upon, when a businessman is called upon to make a decision, like Blau was called upon to make in 1961, supposedly, shall I increase my prices or not? Think of all of the interests that he's supposed to protect here. And how in the dickens can he know what justice requires in all these cases? If I raise wages, I give more to the workers in the steel industry. But what is the long-term effect on employment? Perhaps these workers will be benefited at the expense of the next generation of workers in the steel industry because the higher wages will compel economizing in labor, the introduction of more machinery, and over the long run, fewer jobs. If I raise my prices, that will enable us to secure more investment capital. But that investment capital will be obtained in part from other industries which would also like that investment capital. If we raise prices, we can pay bigger dividends to shareholders. Are shareholders entitled to bigger dividends? How big a dividend is a shareholder entitled to? What are the responsibilities of a businessman to his suppliers, to his consumers, to his labor force, to the other people in management, to the general public, to the armed forces, to the balance of payments? If you try to make these decisions on the basis of conscience, you're going to come up with a bad case of multiple schizophrenia. You can't do it. Just suppose you were put in charge of a group of people and told, all right, now you make all of them happy. Many of us are so arrogant as to think we could do it. We just don't have the knowledge. And with the best will in the world, if business, this is worth reflecting on. If every businessman in the country were a saint, we could not rely upon conscience to do society's economizing task, because he would have to be an omniscient saint. Now, suppose, though, that this knowledge could somehow be acquired. Suppose that businessmen did know how to use resources and what prices to set and all that, and the decision to set a certain price is a decision to use a certain quantity of resources or combination of resources. Suppose businessmen had the requisite knowledge. They would still lack the will, the incentive. They would still be subject to the temptation to rationalize. Are you willing to trust somebody who obviously has an axe to grind with a decision like this? How much power are you willing to give to somebody who you know in advance is not disinterested? Finally, though, even if businessmen had all this knowledge and had the incentive and the best will in the world, I submit that an economic system which must rely upon the conscience of businessmen to perform effectively is intolerable to free men. I would prefer, I think, to live in a society where the economy sort of bumbled along and made a lot of mistakes, and where there was a certain amount of inequity, stress, strain, maladjustment, and so on, I would prefer that to a society in which a group of men, despots, made benevolent decisions for me. A despot is a despot, no matter how benevolent he is. The trouble with a benevolent despot is you never know when he ceases to be benevolent. And democracy is the assumption that nobody can be trusted to make decisions for the people. People don't make very good decisions anyway. But democracy is predicated upon the belief that while you don't get perfect results by consulting the people, you are likely to get even worse results by not consulting them. Don't trust anybody. Like old Thomas Jefferson's remark, every now and then we've got to refresh the tree of liberty with the blood of a few tyrants. Now, I don't think that businessmen are tyrants, because this comes under the final point. I'm not going to be able to demonstrate this, and I'm sure many of you will be unhappy with what I'm going to say, but we come back to the question, well, how competitive is the economy? Is it, as some people like Gardner Means say, just dominated by monopoly and oligopoly and administered prices and all this? I think not. I think we are guilty of the steel automobile obsession. When people start thinking about the American economy, they focus first on General Motors and then United States Steel. It's amazing how often people do this, as if these were the only two corporations in the country. Well, there are, I believe, about 11 million business firms in the country, of which U.S. Steel and General Motors are only a small part. And we even underestimate the extent of competition in the automobile and steel industry, which are two of the most non-competitive industries in the country. When you start thinking about the things that you buy day by day, the goods and services which cater to your standard of living, aren't most of them produced under highly competitive conditions and sold under competitive conditions? Isn't it true that when you go forth to buy, when you take your income and you say, what shall I do with it, nobody has much of a chance to exploit you. You have a wide range of good alternatives. And that means that you've got a lot of freedom. That means there's a lot of competition. That means that business people, businessmen, business firms have to cater to your whims, your needs, your desires, whatever you want to call them. And that is almost the definition of a competitive economy. That by casting a few more votes in favor of this product, you are encouraging society or the social economy to shift gears and produce a little bit more of this. You think of food and clothing, basic needs, produced and sold under highly competitive conditions. The way in which prices of food have come down since the 1930s because of the development of the supermarket, which in turn was made possible largely by the development of the automobile. See, once you had an automobile so that you could travel easily, 1 mile, 2 miles, to get your groceries once a week, grocery stores came into competition with each other. Then it was possible for them to become large because they could potentially serve a wide area because of the improved transportation system. And today, we Americans have a fabulously creative, productive, efficient system of food distribution. Just stop to think about it sometime, especially those of you who live in a big city. Try to match the prices by growing the stuff in your backyard. When you say, but food prices have gone up, don't forget the fact that much of this is due to greater processing. We used to be content to buy our beans in the store and clean them and snap them and all that. Nowadays, we buy them so you just pop them in a pan for 5 minutes. Of course, you're paying for this. You're paying for the convenience. It is my judgment, and I think it is the judgment, too, of almost all economists who have specialized in the area of competition and public policy, that the American economy is highly competitive. We've grossly exaggerated the extent of monopoly. We have underestimated the effects of inter-product competition, new technology, and just in general, the good range of choices which are available to buyers, whereby competitive pressure is maintained, economic order is preserved, and tolerable equity is secured. Well, I'm going to stop with that and now shift into something else. What I've said, in effect, is that we got to rely on competition to economize. We can't rely on morality. Morality won't work. It won't do an acceptable job. And if it did work, it would be intolerable. And as a matter of fact, competition does do a pretty good job. I would like to see an end to this economics of admonition, as Dr. Ben Lewis has called it. where presidents are always lecturing labor leaders and businessmen on setting moral prices. I'm getting so fed up with it. This whole wage increases proportionate to productivity increases is a good example. I won't get into the analysis of it. But if these recommendations of the president, which come out every year in the president's economic report, were really followed, if every businessman picked up his moral responsibilities and every labor leader did the same thing, we would soon have such a mess that we would have to lift these recommendations in order to get the economy functioning again. How ridiculous can you get? We engage in moral admonitions on the assumption that nobody will follow them, because if everybody did, at least not many people will follow them, because if everybody did follow them, we'd soon be in a bind. What is being assumed, you see, in this official presidential wage price policy, the guideposts as they're called, is that nothing ever changes. Demand never changes, technology never changes, nothing is supposed to change. But in fact, things do change. And these guideposts provide no scope for change. It's a very static system of guideposts. And of course, what happens? The president says 3.2% is a patriotic wage increase. The United Automobile Workers come along and get a 7% wage increase, and the president looks at it and says, that seems to me to be within the guideposts. Well, now, got half an hour left, and I want to talk about, make some concluding remarks about what the businessman ought to be. I have said over and over again that ethics is not so much a matter of doing as of being or becoming. That the good, which is the central concern of ethics, is whatever a good man does. But what does a good man do? And one answer, and not a trivial one or a mocking answer, is this one. Watch a good man and see what he does. And then you will know what a good man does. Now, this answer at least calls attention to two important facets of the general problem of ethics. In the first place, by saying that to find out what the good is, you must watch a good man in action. When we say that, we point out that it is impossible to lay down in advance a set of behavioral rules that will differentiate right from wrong in even a significant fraction of the actual dilemmas people encounter. You can't do it. If you think you can, I challenge you to try it. Every situation is unique. Every situation, therefore, requires a brand new decision. And an ethical decision is only going to be made by an ethical man who knows the situation, discerns what ought to be done, and does it. And none of us can tell him in advance what the content of his action will be. Those people who persist in the belief that if only certain rules are obeyed, we will have ethical conduct in business, these people are much too abstract. They're living in the ivory tower. They are far too disrespectful toward the particular and the concrete, the uniqueness of each situation. They are naive in their failure to recognize the rationalizing ability within each of us, so that if you do lay down a rule, we all know how to get around it. And I think such people are doomed to continual frustration of their expectations. We ain't going to do it that way. But now, there's a second thing that this calls attention to. When I say to find out what the good is, watch a good man and see what he does, this calls attention to the problem of becoming, which is the crucial and persistent problem in really serious ethical inquiry. How does a man become what he ought to be? And, of course, what ought a man to be? In the last analysis, I find that all inquiry into business ethics comes back to these questions. Who is the businessman? What ought he to be? What are his resources for becoming what he ought to be? To wit, a good man. But what is a good man? Well, some of you have been complaining that I don't define terms. And I do this for a reason, because I'm definitions of terms are, at the beginning, are a good way of eliminating thought. If I have defined terms sometimes at the beginning, and people get so indignant at my definitions that they don't pay any attention. I'd rather go on through and see if at the end there isn't a definition implicit in what I'm saying. But anyway, I would give you right now a definition of a Christian businessman. It is a man in business who is fully human by virtue of his being in Christ. A definition of a good businessman, eliminating the Christian, would be a man who is fully human. But when I say by virtue of his being in Christ, I'm talking about a Christian businessman, and I'm suggesting the resource for becoming fully human. I am very much concerned that businessmen become human. The businessman today operates under a tremendous disadvantage, and I think this is the source of much of his current moral anxiety. He has been taught, he has come to believe, that business is concerned with the materialistic side of life, with grubby things. I wrote down some quotations here from a guy who's a friend of businessmen, Joseph McGuire, who's dean of the School of Business at the University of Kansas. In his book, Business and Society, which received an award a couple of years ago for being an excellent book, he writes this way. Now, he's a friend of businessmen. He writes, business is a way of life wherein materialistic wants are satisfied. Or again, nearly everything is business that in some way satisfies materialistic human wants. Or again, it seems that almost anything we mention in our American society has some materialistic business tinge. Then he goes on to say that our art isn't really very good. And our songs aren't really very good because they all have this materialistic, i.e. business, tinge. And the businessman swallows this sort of stuff. And this is nonsense. This is utter drivel. There is nothing materialistic about business. Absolutely nothing. When anybody says that the businessman is concerned with the material side of life, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He is literally talking nonsense. What in the world does that statement mean? A businessman produces refrigerators. Is that concerned with the material side of life? Granted, a refrigerator is material, but what isn't? A pastor who is engaged in the building program, isn't he concerned with the material side of life? A doctor who swabs your throat, isn't he concerned with the material side of life? What that we handle isn't material. Well, you say, that's true, but we're thinking about the ends. The businessman is serving materialistic ends. What in the dickens is a materialistic end? Aren't all ends, goals, ultimately subjective? You say, when you want a steak, that's a materialistic goal. When you want to listen to a symphony concert, that's a non-materialistic goal. Oh, bilge. You want the steak for the same kind of reason that you want the symphony concert. It makes you feel good. And to get the good feeling that comes from a good meal, I think there's something tremendously spiritual about a good steak. But you've got to use material things to get spiritual kicks. God is a materialist. I'm a materialist. I'm a rampant materialist. And the more I hear the word spiritual used in church on Sunday morning, the more materialistic I become. The word became flesh and dwelt among us. When you determine the wages of employees in a hairpin factory, that's materialism. When you determine the wages of the first violin section in the Minneapolis Symphony, that's spiritualism. Bilge. Businessmen are engaged in the task, like a lot of us, of organizing scarce resources in such a way as to achieve the maximum of what is wanted. Businessmen are engaged in the task of using what we've got rationally. Their great slogan is not materialism, but economy. And economy is a value. There's nothing grubby or materialistic about economy. Economy has a lot to do with art. You go into a theater, a downtown theater, you know, one of these things built back in the 1920s, and you look up at the ceiling with all this ornamentation and goop and yuck. And what are you objecting to? It's overdone. It's not economical. A line sketch by this Swiss painter, Paul Klee. One of the things that attracts you is the economy. A good poet is economical. Shakespeare could have said, Shakespeare could have written this. The inevitable human tendency to deliberate before acting and to ponder both the motives and consequences of an action frequently deters us from making and implementing a vital decision. If he had written that, he would not have been a great writer, an artist. Instead, he wrote, "Conscience doth make cowards of us all." Economy is a value. Art and economy are intimately related. And I pick on art because we all agree that art is noble. And we think that economy is way down there. Economy is a value in and of itself. Taking things that are given to us and using them in such a way as to bring forth the best that we can out of them. That's economizing. We do it all the time. Waste is not bad, it seems to me. It seems to me waste is not bad mainly because it wastes things, but because it is a denial of our capability as creators. We rebel against having something left over, don't we? We've got to put it all to work. Little kid building in the sandbox. He makes all kinds of roads and tunnels and everything else, and then he sees there's a corner of the sandbox that he hasn't used yet, and he's got to bring that in. He's got to put it all to work. Kid's a little artist. Businessmen are artists. Now, I'm not suggesting that every time a businessman orders paper clips, he's doing something on a par with Aaron Copland. I don't want to reduce it to absurdity. But if the businessman can only see that he too has been given materials, like the violinist and the preacher and the doctor and you name your noble profession, he too has been given materials out of which he can create. If he looks at his job in this way and stops believing the ridiculous canard that he's concerned with the grubby materialistic side of life, then the businessman will find it possible to have a real zest for his vocation. This is the term that Alfred North Whitehead used back in 1927 in his address upon the occasion of the opening of the Harvard School, Graduate School of Business Administration. He talked about the necessity for having a zest for business and thought this is what business schools ought to be inculcating, not teaching people specific little abilities. Unfortunately, this is what business schools do today. You take a course in production management, and you learn 17 rules of sound business management. I have read through these things. I can't stand them. I never finished one of the books. But 17 rules, which a student sits there and learns, like, do not hire too many relatives. Or another, I like these two. This was under a common causes of business failure. Number 9 was overcapitalization. You say, oh, good, I'll avoid that. Next one is undercapitalization. Instead of teaching all of this stuff, I think what business schools ought to be doing is creating in the future businessmen a real passion for what they're going to be doing. Now, how do you do this? This is a tough task, and that's why the business schools don't do it. But it's much easier to teach them the 17 principles of production management than to give these guys a zest for their vocation. The businessman today, when he asks himself, how can I justify what I am doing? You know, subtle little desire in here again. What's the meaning of what I'm doing? He tends to go back to the tired notion that it's the service that he performs to the community. I say this is a tired notion because I don't think the businessman believes it, and neither does anybody else. Businessmen like to say that we, too, are a service profession. There's a great deal of yak-yak about business becoming a profession, like lawyers and doctors who give service to the public. Oh, fish. As long as the businessman believes that that's the only way he can find meaning in what he's doing, by convincing himself that he's providing service, I think he is doomed. One of the many things I like about Carol Hinderly is he keeps knocking this idea of service. What's the last line of the Table Grace?
Strengthen
for thy service. You know, it's got to be working, you know, all the time. God's assigned that he reads off the work assignments in the morning. This morning in Bible study, I asked, what do we owe God for all he has done to us? And nobody said, and I was too tired to say it, one of the things we owe him is the enjoyment of God. Above all, this is what we want. We sometimes make fun of the old Calvinists. There were people who were dominated by work and no pleasure. Calvinists said, what is the end of man? It is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. And where is this notion? In the enjoyment of God, through the enjoyment of the things that he has given to us. He has given us this world to subdue, to refashion, to make something out of, and to enjoy. In the process of creating, we enjoy. We become more. We actualize our potentiality, to use Aristotle terminology. A man who cannot do this, a man who does not for some reason do this, goes to seed. He really does. The retired man who goes quietly mad. The unemployed man who finds that the psychological stress of unemployment is more severe than the financial strain. The man who is frustrated in his work is actually saying that he finds no opportunity to create in what he is doing. Man is a creator as well as a creature, and this includes the businessman. Now, it's certainly true the potential of men differs enormously, but every man who fails to create to the extent that he has the power to create fails to become the man that he ought to be. I'm using man, as someone said, in the sense of embracing woman. production, I'm saying production is not solely for the sake of consumption. Production is worth doing for its own sake. But of course, subject to the law of economy, there is a certain functionalism about production. This is one of the good emphases in modern art, although I think it may be carried too far, or in architecture, I mean. The stress upon the functional, that there is beauty in something which is functional. But you can push this so far, you can make a school building completely functional, and I think many of our school buildings today are ugly, terribly ugly. And I'm almost ready to go back to the old ornate Baroque things.
What does that mean?
Huh? It means ugly. No. It means fancy, florid. Decorations. No decorations, And nowadays, if an architect draws in some fancy scroll work, what's that doing there? Maybe it's just to please the eye of the beholder. Anyway, production is worth doing for its own sake. Participation in the activities of business, whether you're an executive, a lower management person, a salesman, an accountant, an engineer, I don't care what, you've got to find some reason for creating and all this, some way of creating all this. I know this sounds very vague.
Yeah, that'd be nice, but you've never seen my job.
Well, that's true, and it is certainly true that in some jobs it is easier to be creative than in others, but I am convinced that it is not so hard as many of us suppose. Now, one of the reasons why we suppose that it's so hard to be creative is because we are always end-oriented. We are constantly asking ourselves the question, what is the ultimate goal which I am serving in doing this? Now, here I am. Take the horrible example. I'm just putting this little screw in this little wing here or something like that. And then you're supposed to find meaning in your work by saying, but this will go on here, and it will go on here, and eventually and then wind up at somebody's house and enable them to look at a color TV picture. Oh, fiddle. That doesn't work. In teaching, I talk most easy about this. I used to have this idea that I used to try to get pleasure out of teaching by thinking of all these minds that would pass through my classroom and then go forth into the world and make a better world. Nuts. It doesn't work. Every class situation is a unique opportunity. Today, I have an opportunity to create something. And I don't care anymore whether these students even remember any economics when they get out of the classroom. I really do care. But I'm not worried about that. Each classroom situation is an opportunity to create something for the students and me jointly to create something. And I go period by period. I do organize my lectures somewhat, but I'm focusing. What it comes down to is focusing on the particular, the concrete. These are the things that God has given to us. Particular concrete things, particular concrete people. And we have a tendency to generalize and to erect universals to talk about the college student. I have never met the college student. to today's college student. I get sick. I hear people talking about what's wrong with today's college student. Oh, fiddle. There's 100 million things wrong with them, and 100 million things right with them, too. And each one is so marvelous all by himself that one wishes that he just had one student to teach. Now, I don't want to be interpreted as in any way endorsing the Puritan gospel of work. This idea that you've got to get out there and improve, how doth the little busy bee improve each shining hour. You know, in the village blacksmith, why do we love him? Because at 5 o'clock in the morning we could hear his hammer striking the anvil. This kind of being driven is not what I'm after at all. Americans do an awful lot of bustling around today, making work for themselves to do. And this is a symptom of frustration, not a sign of productivity. And I think it's largely because we today are still Puritans at heart. We still feel that we, if we are to be justified in life, in our vocation, we must be justified by our accomplishments. And so you've got to keep accomplishing. And as a result, we have a lot of people who are incapable of either really creating anything or of stopping to create and lying in a hammock. We can neither work nor leisure. We don't know what either one means anymore. We are driven too much today to our work by a sense of guilt, worthlessness, meaninglessness. And this may be conducive to great technical achievements. It is sometimes claimed that this Puritan ethic was responsible for the industrialization of the Western world. Maybe so. Maybe technical achievements, but not human achievements. Great human achievements will never come about because we are Puritans. The greatest achievement of a man is to become the full measure of his own potentiality. And now I'd like to suggest three little things that he must learn to do. Don't write these down. That's right. Remember them for the test. This is one of the things I think is wrong with college teaching today. Students take too many notes. The reason they take notes is because professors are going to ask them details of what they said in class. And they go, I never make a test up on the basis of what I said in class. Tests are based on the things they have read and their ability to think. And what I want the students to do is sit there and listen and respond to what I'm talking about. What the businessman must do is, in the first place, he has to learn to accept with enthusiasm the world that has fallen into his hands. Got to think about what that means. In theological terms, that means he must receive all things with thanksgiving. His first response to what he has should be thanksgiving. That we have to look at things as a part of the creation. And we do this by acknowledging the Creator, that it has been given to us. That things are not hurdles to be overcome, but in the first instance, they are gifts. Secondly, we must learn to fashion our world without fear or guilt. Go out and make a better mousetrap, even though it turns out that it snaps on your fingers and not on the mouse. Go ahead and have a shot at it, free from fear and guilt. In theological language, man must learn that he is justified by grace and not by his mousetraps. And finally, the businessman must learn to respond to the particulars of his world as particulars, to see the uniqueness of each situation, and especially of each person with whom he comes in contact. The business people with whom I am least sympathetic are salesmen and advertisers, because they are the ones most addicted toward generalizing about people, putting people in categories. Now, when you get them away from their business, they frequently turn out to be nice guys. But for example, when an insurance salesman comes in How do you do? He says, I'm Joe Jukes. And I say, how do you do? I'm Paul Hain. How are you, Paul? I say, fine, Mr. Jukes. And he says, well, Paul, you know, he keeps using my first name over and over and over again to get it down in his mind. And he's not respecting me, the particularity of me. He's saying, here's another guy who, if you use his first name, he warms to you. And he doesn't know. He wouldn't buy it. Well.
Did you throw the word daily into your first one?
Daily?
In your first one.
I didn't. I mean,
could you?
Yeah. Yeah. The world of daily comes in your hands. Is that what you mean?
No, would you mean
the first one was accept with enthusiasm the world that comes into his hands. Yeah, every day.
Daily
comes into his hands. Yeah. Each day, get up with a... I know, I'm a mystic, I warn you. But each day I get up and I'm amazed that the sun rose. Some of my scientific friends have told me it doesn't really rise, but that the earth turns, but I don't believe that. Well, I don't know. When you talk about this last thing, respecting the particularity of each thing and each person, you're talking about love. This is what love is. Love is not a matter of overwhelming with affection or of making somebody over in your image of what he ought to be. And sometimes you do that, you know, by loving only those attributes which you find lovable. But love is a matter of accepting the other individual in his uniqueness and overcoming the separation which his uniqueness creates. The joy of love is that we are different. And that everybody is unique, and the opportunity to love each individual is a brand new one.
Can you repeat that again, please?
I can't. Besides, you might write it down if I did. The businessman, the good businessman, is not going to be a driven man. He's not going to neglect his family for the sake of his job, or he's not going to suppose that as a businessman he's interested only in commercial issues. He's going to read something besides the Wall Street Journal. For the Christian businessman, the whole world is his oyster, and a small part within it is his particular gift and opportunity. Now, this all, you know, people are saying, I wanted ethical advice, and here's where I wind up, talking like this. But you see, such a man will know what to do, and he will do it when he's confronted with a problem in business ethics. You say, but all businessmen aren't that way. Right, they're not. But if businessmen are not men such as this, it is certain that no course in business and society, or no seminar on ethics, no industry code, no rules for fair practice will make a noticeable difference. What you're telling me is what I'm recommending isn't practical because businessmen aren't that way and aren't likely to become that way. I say, well, maybe not. But business ethics isn't going to do the job either. And the nice thing about my approach is that it at least gets at the root of the problem. The root of the problem is not how businessmen behave. That's not an ethical problem, primarily. Mostly a problem in law and economics. Competition, legal restraints. This is how we should control business behavior. The problem of business ethics is making businessmen, enabling businessmen to become more human. Perfectly timed. No time for any questions.
What happened to the president?
What happened to the president?
President.
Well, I picked on him.
Oh, I see.
I said they ought to stop. Yeah, the president. I said the president of the United States should cut out economics by admonition. This is what Samson did. You know, they try to slay problems with the jawbone.
I think I'll play the Star Spangled Banner so I can find a seat.
You got a little time to stretch.